Welcome to On Mic, conversations from Northgate Hall, the home of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the J School. As one of the nation's top journalism programs, we regularly host the best reporters, writers, and documentarians to talk about the stories behind their stories. Our On Mic guest today is Franklin Foer.
There are lots of people who want your attention, and they want your attention because they make money off of your attention.
Franklin is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and former editor of The New Republic. He's author of a new book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. In today's episode, one of our esteemed lecturers, Deirdre English, sat down with Franklin to discuss how big tech companies like Google and Facebook are changing the way we create and consume journalism. It's On Mic, Deirdre English in conversation with Franklin Foer.
Franklin, you're here because you've just written an incredible book about the impact of big tech on journalism.
Thank you.
Which has changed the way that I'm thinking, and I think you're, you know, raising one of the most important questions of our time. I mean, when I finished reading your book, I kind of thought, this is like global warming. It's worse than I thought.
People always ask me, why are you so critical? Why did you decide to write a critique? And of course, the book is framed as a critique. But in my own mind, I never really thought of it as a critique as much as a defense, that there are these things that I love, that I feel are precious to individuals and to our society and to our democracy. And so under assault by not just cultural forces, but by economic forces and by these companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple. The founders of the companies, sure, they want to make money, but they're also very, very idealistic, and they have a view of human nature that they want to impose on the rest of us.
But, you know, what do you do? I mean, do you have a smartphone? Do you use Facebook? I know you do. You know, did you use Google when you were writing this book? I mean, do you think we have to give up using this kind of technology if we share your criticism?
I'm somewhat ashamed to admit my own addiction to these products. Part of it is that I'm dependent on them, that it's amazing. These products are incredible tributes to human creativity. And social media is a lot of fun. And the phone is just always there. But my problem with these technologies, with these sites, is that they're addictive. And not just addictive because we're human beings, but they're addictive because they've been designed to addict. All the data that they've accumulated about us, all the ways in which they've tracked us everywhere we read, everywhere we travel, is leveraged against us. There's this jujitsu that they perform where they peer into our brains, they do the math, and then they use that against us to keep us checking all the time.
You know, I wanted to describe an experience I had and get you to analyze it. I was reading a review of your book in the LA Times, and I got about a third of the way through it, and suddenly a screen jumped up in front of me on my smartphone, basically asking me if I wanted to watch last night's late night comics, you know, commenting on Trump's speech at the UN. So I sort of thought, oh, God, maybe I could just take a little detour and, you know, see what Colbert said about Trump before I finish reading this review. Now, would you analyze what happened in that experience I had?
Well, I mean, I think the analysis of it was implicit in everything that you just described, which is that there are lots of people who want your attention, and they want your attention because they make money off of your attention. So they've engineered all of these systems and platforms in order to obtain as much of that as possible. And some of that attention stealing grows out of data, so the way in which they know you. But a lot of it is just based on an understanding of mass psychology, the way that people think. And it's so hard to resist that because it's coming at you. You're not making a choice to watch some of these things. The distraction is hosed at you. And it feels sometimes like you don't have a choice.
But it is more demanding to read a book review than it is to watch a video. It's just easier.
Right. And it's one of the things that I resent about Facebook, which is that Facebook's constantly changing its algorithm to prioritize one thing over another. But in the last year or so, it's elevated video. And if you elevate one thing, it comes at the expense of another. And so we're just bombarded. If you use Facebook to consume news or for entertainment, moving images are what you get as opposed to words. And I like moving images, but I believe that words are uniquely important to us as thinking human beings. Words require a certain amount of concentration. The nature of reading is that it's actually one of the most interactive mediums you could possibly design. In order to make sense of those words and paragraphs on a page, it demands focus.
You were the editor of the New Republic magazine twice, and I want to focus on the second time that you were the editor.
Just as everybody focuses on Grover Cleveland's second term. So the magazine was bought in 2012 by a guy called Chris Hughes. And Chris was Mark Zuckerberg's roommate at Harvard. And he was one of the three founders of Facebook, one of its early employees. And he came to the New Republic, and he was our savior. He walked in and said, "I believe in what you do. I want to save long-form journalism. I'm committed to the values of high culture. And I'm going to help you survive in a way that will be dignified. All the rest of journalism has tripped itself up making this transition to this new world. There's so much pandering that happens. There's this diminishment of quality. But I'm going to give you my expertise, my deep pockets, and together we'll reinvent journalism in a way that we can be proud of."
Well, this is a dream come true.
It was dreamy to me, and I didn't really apply too much skepticism to it. But he asked me to come back and edit the magazine again. I said, "Sign me up."
Yeah.
And it was a hell of a lot of fun because at first we were committed to this mission. But there was a problem, which is that as beautiful as that mission is, it's also very, very difficult. And Chris wasn't content to merely be the savior of long-form journalism. He wanted to show that he could succeed as a business person as well. And so at the very least, we had to turn around our revenue. And I didn't really take him seriously when it came to his desire to build revenue initially, because he was skeptical of advertising, and he just didn't seem to have his heart in that part of the project. And so we spent a lot of money, but there was a day that inevitably arrived where Chris said, we need to cut our losses. We need to turn the arrow around, and here's how it's going to happen. I come from social media. I know the tricks for making things work on social media. We need revenue. Revenue comes from traffic. Traffic comes from being successful on Facebook. And so we set about changing our DNA. He talked about producing snackable content, which is one of these phrases that I loathed as soon as it came out of his mouth. But I thought, what the hell? It's an okay compromise to make as long as I can preserve the things that I care about most. But by snackable content, he meant that there were pieces that you would see on Facebook while you were standing on the subway platform that you would instantly want to read because you were in a frame of mind where you wanted to decompress after a day's worth of work. So there were two things that happened. One is that he installed a data guru on our team. There was somebody who was able to parse the numbers to see what's most successful, where our targets of opportunity lie. And a lot of this meant looking at what was trending on Facebook. This is a pretty central part of my critique, because what I'm arguing is that Facebook seems as if it's allowing us all to pursue our own interests, to express ourselves individually. But when it comes to the way the media works, everybody wants to ride the same wave of popularity to try to attain the same possibility of viral success. And instead of creating niches and individuality, what you see is this convergence. Everybody is rushing to the same topics. There was one example in my book about a photo of a hunter who'd killed a celebrity lion called Cecil. And this story about Cecil the lion and his untimely and unfortunate death generated 3.2 million stories. And every news outlet, no matter their their high-mindedness or aspirations joined in this pile-on. And to me, that perfectly reflects the problem that we face.
Didn't you start to actually judge your different writers by how much traffic they were driving?
The publisher of our magazine had metrics that he used to parse, I guess you would call it the efficiency of every writer. So he would show how productive they'd been in terms of actual articles produced, and then how productive they've been in the amount of traffic that each of those articles had generated. And then it was possible to see how much revenue each of the writers had brought in versus their salaries. So we had an incredible art critic called Jed Pearl, who's gone on to write. He's now the in-house art critic at the New York Review of Books. And he was pretty game to take on the mission of writing for the web. But when he wrote for the web, he'd write the same type of articles that he would write when he was writing for print about whatever the latest exhibit was, you know, at the National Portrait Gallery or the Museum of Modern Art. And not surprisingly, those pieces were not traffic gold. And so he just came out terribly in our metrics. And there was this pressure to fire him that I faced. And if not fire him, then at least squeeze him financially.
And yet you felt that he was one of the more original thinkers in the world of art criticism that you had come across.
He had authority. Everybody in the world, everybody in the museum world, and the gallery world respected him. They feared him. They wanted to know his opinion about things. He mattered in the world. And that was important to me as an editor. You had a chance to employ the person who was most respected at it, who wrote about it stylishly and argumentatively and with a real depth of knowledge and aesthetic sensibility, then why wouldn't you want to maintain that person on your staff? He couldn't produce snackable content. That was the point.
I'd like to take you back to a story that you tell about a time when you were sitting in Widener Library at Harvard and looking at some old issues of The New Republic, and you had a shocking realization.
I was going through all the old files of The New Republic. Somebody went to the basement and pulled and used dollies to just bring old file cabinets up to my desk in the library. And I sat there and I just started rifling through them. And the thing that was striking to me was that, you know, I started to see what people were paid, and that in the height of the Great Depression, the worst financial catastrophe that we've seen in the past 100 years, writers were getting paid $150 to turn in book reviews. And what was astonishing to me and just incredibly deflating and dispiriting was that was the same amount that we were paying writers to publish reviews on our website. So 150 years later, going from the financial trough of all financial troughs to the present, without adjusting for inflation or the cost of living or anything, the price of a book review had completely stagnated.
So this is kind of unbelievable. The amount of money that writers are paid has just radically declined. And today, writers can barely make a living from writing. Isn't that true?
It's true, which is why we see that as a profession, we've gotten younger and younger, and that it's become harder and harder for people to imagine a path that would allow them to live in a big city, to raise kids in a big city, and to keep on writing. It's just hard.
So the big tech companies have been capturing journalism. So they're monetizing the content, they're selling ads against it, but they're not sharing that revenue with the publications and the authors.
So what happened is that the value of an ad has been radically deflated. It used to be, to buy an ad in the New York Times when it was a paper edition, you'd have to spend $100,000 to buy an ad. You'd pay real money for that. But now, when you buy a piece of digital advertising, it sits on that website for a long period of time. You have to get millions of impressions sometimes in order to fulfill an ad campaign. And so the price has just been deflated, radically deflated. And that's hurt traditional media. It's hurt new media, because it's just hard to monetize the product. But the one set of companies it hasn't hurt are Facebook and Google. Because their audiences are so large, because they have so much data, they can parse that audience any which way an advertiser wants. And so Google and Facebook have benefited from this radical deflation of the advertising market. And in fact, I would argue that they've even, in a lot of ways, tried to accelerate it by making it even more inefficient to buy ads through mainstream media. This is a conundrum for these companies, right? Google and Facebook don't really produce anything. They don't produce journalism.
And also, they're getting extremely rich. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is one of the world's five richest people, along with also people like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos. But Mark Zuckerberg is alone, and yet these big tech companies have not created a lot of jobs.
No. And in fact, you could argue that there's a bait and switch happening, that Amazon, for instance, will demand tax cuts and subsidies to build a warehouse or a new headquarters, which they'll extract from the taxpayers of any given municipality with the promise that jobs will go there. And jobs may go there in the short term, albeit not great ones. But then ultimately, those jobs are just going to get automated away as robots and drones come to work the aisles of those warehouses.
When you think about the future, what's going to happen to writers and what's going to happen to writing?
This is where I think writers need to be enormously defensive, that we need to stand up for what we do and why it matters, because we've seen the ways in which algorithms replace writers. So take a story about a game report from a baseball game, that it's possible to train an algorithm to produce a news story that describes exactly what happened in a baseball game, thus rendering the sports writer irrelevant. And the same thing happens with earthquakes. So if there's an earthquake in Mexico, almost instantly an algorithm can write a report about what happened, and that goes out over the web. And those aren't terribly sophisticated algorithms, and those aren't terribly sophisticated stories to write. But there's no reason to believe that an algorithm couldn't be trained to write more sophisticated stories as we go along. They're formulas that can be replicated extremely easily. You know, I actually do think that this is a long-term threat to the profession of writing.
Your subtitle of your book, you said the existential threat of big tech. So what do you mean? Big tech is an existential threat to what?
To our very definition of what it means to be a human being. Right now, we're in this long process of merging with machines. We've always had tools. They've been great. But right now, we're starting to wear these technologies on our wrists, wear them on the bridge of our nose with Google Glass. They're soon going to be implanted within us. We're going to be merged with machines in a definition-changing sort of way. Along with that transformation, we're in the process of losing very, very precious things. We're losing privacy, which is a prerequisite for thinking. We can't have independent thoughts if we're being watched all the time. So when Brandeis wrote about privacy, he struggled to come up with a good definition that could be used in courts, and his thinking changed over time. The first essay he wrote about privacy in the 1890s was about gossip, and he was worried about people prying into the lives of celebrities, which is invasive, and it's a threat. But he really had this nagging sense that invasions of privacy constituted something much, much worse than that. And as he thought through the problem, I think he got to the nub of it, which is he was worried that we would start to become bad citizens, that in a democracy, citizens have to make choices every so often about who they elect to office, what issues they deem to be the most important. And those are really profound decisions. And in order to make those decisions, you have to be able to formulate your own opinion. If you're just doing what your boss told you to do, or you're just doing what a party organization tells you to do, you're being a bad citizen. The democracy is going to end up suffering because of it. And so he really put a huge onus on us, on each and every one of us, to be thinking individuals. But what he said was that if you think you're being watched, if you don't have the space to kick around ideas in your own head, you're not going to make good decisions. You're going to start to do the popular thing. You're going to try to appease your audience. And I really think we need to go back and revisit what it means to have private spaces, why we care about them, because we're losing them.
And how dangerous a herd mentality can be.
Precisely.
Hannah Arendt wrote about this, too, in the context of resisting fascism. She talked about the importance of solitude, is the word I think she used more than privacy, and saying that the thinker has got to, you know, read and participate in social life, but then has got to retreat into the solitude of their own mind to rethink and reanalyze and follow the course of their own logic and arrive at a strong independent thought.
One of my colleagues at the New Republic, Leanne Wieseltier, who is somebody who styles himself an intellectual in the Hannah Arendt sort of mode. And he said something that I think is a truism, which is sometimes your first thought isn't your best thought. Sometimes, always, we need to turn things around a couple times in our head. We need to kick around bad ideas. You need to entertain the possibility of bad ideas before you dismiss them.
So you believe that social media is actually weakening our minds?
I do. I know that, that's certainly not going to be a popular sentiment, but I think that it weakens our minds because we're given information that we think we play a role in structuring and organizing. We do to some extent, but we ignore the way in which that information is being structured for us by technology companies that are intending to addict us to their material. And so that among the things that they use to addict us is that they play to our political emotions. They give us things that confirm our biases. There's a lot of scaremongering, anxiety-inducing content that's delivered to us frequently. And I do think that it has a destabilizing effect on us.
You know, this makes me want to talk about the Russians and Facebook. This is a very hot subject in the news right now, and you must be following it obsessively, I would guess. What are some of your thoughts about how this occurred and how it's being handled by Facebook?
So Facebook created a system that was almost designed for bad actors to exploit it. So even if we weren't dealing with Russians, it was designed for advertisers and for other people, political candidates, to try to dig really deep into our heads and to give us exactly what we want. And there are examples of this beyond the Russians. ProPublica published an important investigation about how anti-Semites were able to target precisely their audience using the term Jew hater as keywords for.
I think Sheryl Sandberg addressed this, and she said, "It's on us, and it's bad that this happened, but we had no idea that the functionality could be used in this way."
Yes, and so this is the problem, is that there's really no good way for Facebook to address this problem themselves. I mean, I've talked to people who told Facebook during the election that your system is being exploited by troublemakers from outside. And they knew, and they were just dismissive of the problem. And they were dismissive of it because this is the way the system was designed to work in the first place.
Hold on a second. Sheryl Sandberg is Jewish. Mark Zuckerberg is Jewish. How could they knowingly allow Facebook to be targeting anti-Semites who were, you know, looking for things that were connected to Jew hater?
Because they created a system that was algorithmically allowing anybody to reach any audience that they wanted to. And you'd have to be a fool not to know that there are going to be anti-Semites who are trying to exploit that system.
So you're not saying that they knew that anti-Semites were being targeted. You're saying that they knew that they had created a system that had the capacity to target anybody for anything? Is that what you're saying?
I would be shocked if they didn't know. I mean, not that they went looking to confirm that. It's just that you know that there are anti-Semites out in the world who are politically active, who want to reach their target audience, and there was no check in the system to stop them because they didn't believe in placing those sorts of checks in the system.
You know, and yet Facebook is almost like a government in a weird way. You know, it's almost like it's got this huge nation of Facebook followers, but it doesn't have checks and balances.
And it doesn't. By design, it doesn't have checks and balances. And this goes to a key journalism concept, which is the concept of the gatekeeper. Gatekeeper is a term that was developed to describe powerful institutions or individuals who stood between readers and the information. Somebody has to make a decision about what's important.
Well, editors
are gatekeepers, exactly. And Facebook is a gatekeeper. Facebook stands between its users and the and information.
Passive gatekeepers.
They're passive gatekeepers. That's exactly the point.
And they let the algorithms do their thinking for them instead of editors. But, Frank Foward, do you want Mark Zuckerberg to play more of a role as a gatekeeper or an editor? Do you want him to determine what can and cannot be on Facebook?
This is an extremely sticky thing because, on the one hand, in the short term, I think he almost needs to play that sort of role. Google does this, I think, with ISIS training videos, where they've structured their algorithm to try to stem the influence of those training videos. And part of me says, you know, kudos to them for trying to protect the public good. But then I, on the other hand, one has to say, well, that's a hell of a lot of power. And even if they're using it in a benevolent sort of way, aren't we troubled by that? And so ultimately, I think in the short term, we can say, all right, Mark Zuckerberg, do what you can do to prevent foreign actors from buying ads that influence elections in any given jurisdiction. But ultimately, that's not what we want.
I just want to say that I think we're right up to the point of this is the question. You're here at the University of California at Berkeley, where we are just struggling with this issue of free speech, and that we are obligated as a public university to allow speech that we disagree with, even hate speech, to present itself on this campus, because we're not a private university, so we have to do it. But Facebook doesn't have to have free speech, and I'm a big believer in free speech.
Right. Yet, if Facebook is essentially like a government and it plays a function that is akin to a public square, we don't want them to be especially active in shutting down free speech. I think what we want is we want there to be pluralism of venues. And this is where we go back to the whole subject of monopoly and antitrust, that there really isn't a good answer to any of these sticky questions that we're talking about the power of Facebook or Google to regulate speech if they are the only game in town. And so we have solutions at hand, which is to minimize the power of these companies.
I'm really glad that we're arriving at this because, again, on the subject of hope and solutions, you really do talk about starting to treat these companies as monopolies. And it's so interesting that your father had a background as an antitrust lawyer. I can see that you know a lot about this. So you believe they should be busted up, broken up?
I do. I would consider just finding ways to use government policy to create a pluralistic marketplace. It'll be a long time before we could ever get public support in the political system to gravitate in that sort of direction. But there's a very, very proud history in this country of using the power of government to try to curtail private power, especially as it relates to communications. And there's a totally fascinating history of this going back to the first monopoly, which was the Postal Service, and the way in which the government didn't extend the Postal Service's monopoly into the telegraph business, and the way in which we let Western Union get a monopoly eventually in telegraph, but the government was so aggressive in threatening to nationalize Western Union that Western Union was terrified about getting into the telephone business. And AT&T basically cut a deal with the government that said, okay, we'll accept a measure of regulation. You can treat us like a utility, and we're not going to get into the radio business. And it goes on and on and on. We broke up NBC into two parts. We created ABC was essentially a government creation because we were afraid that NBC was getting too powerful. And then when the broadcast model was one that we started to get worried about, the Nixon administration pushed for the cable industry to come along. And it's just a pattern that repeats itself over time and a pattern that we've veered away from. We stopped being concerned about concentrations of communication power. And we desperately need to revive that tradition.
Even if we could break up these monopolies, is there an effective business model that would allow creative thinkers and writers to be paid decently again?
So this is among the hardest questions. But there's an anecdote that I found interesting that gave me a measure of hope in thinking this through, which is in the late 1920s, the book publishing industry collapsed, and book publishers were faced with an existential question about how can they revive flagging sales. And they hired a guy called Edward Bernays, who wrote the book on propaganda. He's the founder of public relations as a discipline, and also a relative of Sigmund Freud's. And so he set about puzzling over this problem, and he came up with a fairly ingenious solution, which was bookshelves. He began to work with architects and women's magazines to try to proliferate bookshelves into the middle-class home. Before the 1930s, bookshelves had not been a fixture in middle-class Victorian homes. But thanks to Bernays, it became one. And so why do I tell this story? For a couple of reasons. One is that he managed to create culture as a sign of status and aspiration, which it's always been. But secondly, he showed how marketing can change the way in which we think about culture. And I suggest that there are ways to make people care about the things that they ingest through their minds, about the products that they consume intellectually and culturally. You see glimmers of hope. After this election, the New York Times started to market itself as the antidote to fake news. And that proved to be an incredibly compelling campaign. People have decided that they want to become little Medicis, to become patrons and benefactors of the New York Times because they believe in what the New York Times is doing. And to be associated with the New York Times is to show that they're just not going to accept the situation as it exists now. And also the tech companies have been strangely good at doing this. They've seized ground away from the culture industries and from the publishers and media companies, that if you see an ad for the iPad, it's frequently advertising the iPad as a device that you can use to read the New York Times or do astronomy or do things that are more cultured. The Kindle is something that we see in European cafes in their advertising. And so the culture industry needs to be more self-confident, more robust, more aggressive in selling their product as the pathway to a better life, to a more virtuous life.
Which it really is. And, you know, one of the thoughts I had after reading your book was that the tech industry claims to prize innovation so much. But an incredible source of innovation is in the independent minds of thinkers and writers. So we're really suffering as a culture by drowning our thinkers and our writers and not giving them the economic support to live their lives and have a profession of being a writer. This is really at the peril of our culture.
Exactly. We as individuals need to be engaged in a steady act of self-improvement. We can't just accept things as they're given to us. We can't just accept that our education ends with the last time we set foot in a school. The idea of constantly self-improving and challenging ourselves and carving out the time and space in our own lives where we're disconnected in some way, shape, or form from our devices. We can all be deep thinkers. I mean, and this is another thing that I found so inspiring about turning back to Brandeis was that he was both a populist and a snob, that he could say every human being, every citizen is capable of making good choices in the very momentous decisions that we as a society require them to make. But to do so means that they need to take it upon themselves to be thinkers. And I think it's about time that we as a profession, we as a society, go back to being demanding.
You know, I love that we're talking about this. And I just want to comment that I think it's often very unfair that authors are often asked, you know, you've diagnosed a problem, so what is your solution, you know, or what is the way out, or can't you give us some hope?
A friend of mine called this the last chapter problem.
The last chapter problem, exactly. You know, you've got to come up with some hope.
One of the things that I find so hard now is when I go to events, I feel like young people come up to me and they say, I read your critique, and it's true. I'm stuck in this contest for popularity where I'm trying to produce things that work on Facebook. I'm told that I have to aggregate all the time. I feel like I'm a slave to data. What can you tell me to give me hope? And it's a really hard question. We've been facing versions of this question for the last 10, 15 years in journalism. As the journalism business has been squeezed, it's harder and harder to see what the end game is and how you'll get there. But I've always had the same answer, is that if you love it, you can find a way to make it work. You know, I'm not guaranteeing success in the business, but if you know the animating reasons, your animating reasons for getting into the profession, and if it's something that consumes you and obsesses you and gives you pleasure, everybody has to make sacrifices and do things that they don't want to do on their way to doing the things that they want to do. It's also possible to push back against things that you don't like, to just apply pressure headed in the other direction. There's something brave and bold and beautiful about standing up to the powerful, engaging collectively, or simply pushing back.
And I want to thank you very much, Franklin Foer, for coming to the Graduate School of Journalism to talk about your extraordinary, very argumentative, and very valuable book, World Without Mind. Thank you.
That was hugely enjoyable. Thank you.
We've been listening to Franklin Foer in conversation with Deirdre English. On Mic is a podcast presentation of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Technical facilities for On Mic are underwritten by the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation. Kat Shuknecht is our producer, and I'm Dean Ed Wasserman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us next time for On Mic.